its current state here on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome back. I'm Mark Bayshore. The next time you go in for a medical checkup, don't be surprised if your doctor gets on your case about your weight, if your weight is a problem. The medical profession has issued new guidelines for fighting the nation's obesity epidemic, and they are urging physicians to be a lot more aggressive about helping patients drop extra pounds. If you haven't had your body mass index calculated, you should start preparing for that. Doctors are apparently are being urged to calculate your body mass index. That's a weight to height ratio. And if you need to lose weight, they should come up with a plan and maybe even send you for counseling. At the top of our program today, Michigan government services are inefficient and expensive because important reforms are not taking place. That's the conclusion of a new report from a coalition of state employee labor unions entitled Pure Michigan Waste. 2 years after it first suggested reforms to streamline and improve frontline services to Michigan citizens, the coalition of state employee unions says the state has failed to improve its human capital strategy. Now, in a new report, the group claims that some Michigan governmental departments continue to hire more managers and supervisors than frontline service employees. At least one Snyder administration official is casting doubt on the report. Joining us to explain is a leader of the Coalition of State Employee Labor Unions. Cindy Estrada is also the vice president of the United Auto Workers Union. Welcome to Current State, Cindy.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Before we get into this report, closed-door hearings began yesterday here in Lansing on the impasse between your coalition's members and the state of Michigan regarding a contract. Can you tell us anything regarding yesterday's hearings?
I think they went really well, especially for the state of Michigan workers. I think there was good presentation regarding that. You know, when times are bad in the state of Michigan, workers have continued to come to the table and take concessions, and you know, Michigan is doing better, and therefore the workers should continue to improve as well, or at least stay status quo. So I think that we put on a great presentation yesterday, filled with facts, and I think that the impasse panel is, you know, taking that into consideration.
Was the release of your report on Tuesday meant to influence those hearings or influence opinion about them?
No, the release of our report was, you know, again, just continuing to work on this campaign, which is to get the governor and the administration to really include workers as a way of looking at how you improve state government. I mean, no one knows better than the workers who are in these facilities every day delivering services on how to make it more efficient. And so, you know, we wanted to give it a two-year, the time of the contract, because we did negotiate the new solutions committee, which would deal with privatization, work management to worker ratio, and lean. And so we always wanted to take another look at it 2 years later to see how much we've improved.
Okay. Remind our listeners which specific unions belong to the Coalition of State Employee Unions.
They have the UAW, SEIU, MSCA, MCO, and AFSCME.
And you collectively, those unions represent how many state employees?
Over 34,000 workers.
Now, your group, as you mentioned, as you alluded to here, your group submitted a report to the Snyder administration 2 years ago with recommendations involving human capital. You called it New Solutions for Michigan. Tell us more about what you recommended back in 2011.
So a couple things. You know, overall, what we recommended is that if we really want to drive efficiency, again, you management and workers have to work very closely together. I don't think workers have all the answers, nor do I think management, but it's when they collaborate and begin to change that culture that you're going to drive efficiency the same that we do in the auto industry. The other one was that there was a lot of privatization happening, and especially when I took over in the UAW for this department, we really looked even more into that, and what we were finding is that things were being privatized that could have been done cheaper in the state and even more cheaper if you would have drove the efficiency in the work. And then the other is that there was a really not a great ratio of management to workers. Those who try to be the best in the industry, you look at a 15-to-1, and even in some auto plants, you look at a 25-to-1. So we weren't saying that every department that we knew the answer for the management to worker ratio, but we definitely saw that we need to take a deeper dive. And did it make sense? Are we running the government? Do we need more frontline workers? You know, and the governor agreed with that.
Can you give us a dramatic example of a case where privatization turned out to be more expensive than a full-time state employee?
One we just worked on, we actually won this case for the first time, mostly because the administration in this case, and they haven't done it in any other case, is the workers who deliver the healthcare services in the prisons.
Okay.
Right? We found that you would actually save money if you kept the work in the state. I don't have the exact figure, but then when they bid the work out, some of the efficiencies that even the contractors came up with, if we adopted those efficiencies, you could do it save even more money.
Hmm.
And so we were actually able to save that one. What we're calling on the governor, and that was the first time that happened. They've not done that since. I mean, we've taken work like, some of it's not even saving money. It's just, I think overall it saves money. Veterans Hospital. Right, workers who are delivering the care to our veterans, the most important, you know, they serve this country, they outsourced that work and gave it to workers making $10 an hour. And they have a high turnover, veterans are getting hurt, workers are ending up on food stamps. So I would even say that if you're paying someone $10 an hour, yet they're ending up on the rolls on food stamps, that's hurting the state overall.
Hmm. I am led to believe 2 years ago, on the heels of your New Solutions for Michigan report, that you were encouraged initially by the dialogue with the state government 2 years ago. What was that like?
I was very encouraged. I had discussions with Governor Snyder and his administration, and we had they seemed to really get the importance of lean, and wanted to take a look at the management to worker ratio. Said, agreed that, look, we should only be privatizing if it saves the state money. But what I found is that very little has been done in all three of those areas. We tried to work on some lean projects, and I found very quickly that what the governor's administration is missing is sort of a more deep, thoughtful way of, lean has to include workers, but we still have a system where the administration wants to make the decisions, superficially ask workers by surveys sort of what they want to see changed, but they don't go deep enough. It really means collaborating and working together on a daily basis, bringing in different experts who work on lean and changing that culture. The culture that we all have something to offer and listen to each other. That's not happening.
Let's clarify one of your really central points here, and this is a quote. You say that the state, quote, altogether failed to improve its human capital strategy, unquote, and you maintain that hundreds of managers and supervisors have been added and just a few frontline staff. Assuming you're right about that, you're saying that the discussion just didn't go deep enough when it came to... So the discussion didn't go deep enough, and this is what has resulted?
Yeah, what happened was the governor looked at that and said, if this is true, let's take a look at it, and they sent it to to others in the administration to take a deeper look at the management-to-worker ratio. And the response from the civil service staff at that time was defending sort of the status quo, defending the number of managers and workers. And to me, that is just not how you change a government. We want to be best in class. We shouldn't be comparing ourselves to Illinois and Ohio, who have a 7-to-1 ratio. We should be comparing ourselves to the leaders in the private sector, and like Texas, who's looking to try and do, a 15-to-1 ratio. And so it was, a report that defended what they're doing instead of saying, hey, let's look at this deeper and how can we do this better?
You touched on the issue of ratios of managers to frontline staff. Where are those ratios right now?
I think Kurt Weiss was right when he said it's like a 7-to-1 ratio. It would depend on each department. Again, a reason why we want to take a deeper look. Some departments may need more managers, right, depending on the kind of services, if they're dealing with children, but our point is, what is the right mix? And if you don't look at that with workers and collaborate together, we won't know, right? If you're not driving, when you drive efficiency, you need less managers. So, again, a more thoughtful, deeper look at how we become best in class, not how we defend what we've always done. That's not what I expected from the governor and what he had said when he was running for governor.
We're talking with Cindy Estrada, Vice President of the United Auto Workers Union and a leader of the Coalition of State Employee Labor Unions, who maintain that the state has bungled its efforts here at improving its human capital strategy. Too many managers and not enough frontline staff. You're a UAW official. Everyone in your group is a union official or member, I take it. Are all the managers that you say are getting added non-union, or are any of them unionized?
No, they're not unionized. And again, I think managers, I don't want to say that we don't need managers. I think managers and supervisors are really critical. But do we have the right mix? And so we are, they are not unionized. And we did only look at, I know there was a report out there that we looked at people who weren't managers when we came up with this number, but we did only look at managers and supervisors.
Well, I should say, Kurt Weiss of the State Department of Technology Management and Budget did find a couple of things that he questioned about your report. He did maintain that your report included hundreds of employees as managers who did not supervise any employees. You are denying that you mislabeled those personnel?
Yeah, definitely. The way that we define staff-to-management ratios is routinely used by government, and we only use managers and supervisors. And they made this claim in 2011, too, and got off of it because they were wrong once they looked at sort of our report and the numbers that we use. So I'm sure they'll get off of it again. But I don't like the defensiveness that they're using, because this isn't about being anti-management and anti-supervisor. I want to stress again, this is about how departments, are they set up the most efficient and the most functional? And that's what we're challenging the governor. If we really want to change state government, then we need to get together and look at this and make sure that we have the right mix.
You talk about managers, you talk about frontline workers. How do you define frontline worker? Just give us your working definition of frontline worker.
I mean, it would depend. I mean, we represent so many different classifications, but right now what we were looking at are our employees, those 34,000 workers that work in the state of Michigan that are representative.
And you all,
and then supervisor, you know, we're not including sort of business and administrative positions or confidential positions, which would, I think that's what Mr. Weiss is referring to.
Weiss, yeah.
Weiss, I'm sorry.
You also claim that the state should reduce its reliance on contracted organizations or individuals. From your perspective, what's going on there?
You know, I think this is an ideological sort of position that they're taking in the administration. This idea that contracting out is better. And is there a need, is there a reason to contract out? I think sometimes there is, but if it's saving money, right? When workers can do those jobs just as efficiently in the state, then they should remain in the state.
But isn't working with contract employees often less expensive because it's often temporary work, often with fewer or no benefits?
Sometimes that's true. I would say that could you have a contractor come in and offer poverty wages that, you know, have people exist on food stamps? We have that example with the workers that they're paying to take care of our veterans, right? No benefits, low pay, collecting food stamps. Every taxpayer in Michigan is subsidizing a workforce for a company. I think it's unacceptable to make taxpayers subsidize corporations who are making a profit and sticking taxpayers with the bill. That is not what we're about. I believe in this country. That's not the future I want my children to come into.
Has this discussion with the state, with the Snyder administration, has it come to a halt? Are there still discussions going on? How would you characterize that?
I think presently there's not a lot of discussion going on. I think the administration coming to workers when the governor's going around saying that the economy is improving, there's nothing but growth, this is a comeback state to come after workers for concessions in this round of bargaining, I think shows that in the end of the day, the reason that lean's not happening in the state is because they obviously don't value the workforce that much. That's the impression I'm getting. I would love to have discussions again, because I think that the only way we improve in the state is the administration, management, supervisors, workers, getting into room and understand that we're all vested in this together and that it's only together that things are going to improve. Unfortunately, workers have to fight for that seat at the table because no one's turning to them and say, hey, we value your opinion. We value the work we do. They're showing that by coming up with a concessionary agreement, and they're showing it by, not involving them in sort of getting their input. Just an example, in the state of Michigan, we showed the governor a real lean program. Workers were waiting 3 hours, or citizens, to get benefits in the state. Through a lean program, working with the workers in the UAW, we reduced that to a half hour. Why is that kind of collaboration not happening? It works. The auto industry, if they just defended what they always did instead of trying to look at how to be best in class and how to improve and engage the workforce, they wouldn't be where they are today.
Cindy, is it realistic, though, that this discussion could happen at the same time the contract talks are going on?
Definitely. We welcome it all the time. We wanted to continue, to bargain. Unfortunately, that wasn't the position of the state. So I always welcome those discussions. I always have hope that they'll happen. But I think that when they're not happening and we can't move it, then we need to sort of expose it so that another discussion starts happening to move that.
Cindy, do you expect any kind of detailed response to your report from the Snyder administration or state officials?
I'm not sure. I welcome it. I hope that it's not, let's defend what we've always done. I hope it's a response that, they could disagree with our numbers, but say, let's sit down and figure out how we make improvements
so that services are dealt better. Well, you are making a case for a lean operation. It would seem that you and the Snyder administration would have something significant in common by pursuing a lean approach.
I think that's if people really understand what lean is. Again, lean is a lot of work. It takes a long-term commitment, and it means that one person can't come in the room and think that they have all the answers. And I think that's often why it fails, because people want the results instead of understanding that it's a cultural change first. The conversation has to change. So you would think, but again, I think that I think the understanding in the administration of what lean is doesn't go deep enough.
Is there a particular state department where there's a shortage of frontline workers, in your opinion, where it is extremely noticeable where that shortage exists?
Yeah, I think that's in the Department of Human Services is definitely one of them. We represent those workers, sort of our social workers. Their caseload, 300 cases. I mean, it's very difficult for these workers. These workers have degrees. They do this work because they care about people, and they're definitely understaffed, overburdened, very stressed out, and very, hard cases that they really want to be able to focus more on but just haven't been able to.
Cindy, we want to thank you. Cindy Estrada is the Vice President of the United Auto Workers, but she is also a leader of the Coalition of State Employee Labor Unions. Many thanks.
Okay, thank you.
Author David Eggers received much critical acclaim for his 2000 memoir, A Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius. His newest novel, The Circle, is surrounded by some controversy, including accusations of plagiarism. Current state contributor Scott Southard has this review.
Who owns a story? It's a more complicated answer than you might imagine, especially in the freedom of today's internet age, where everything seems to be becoming more and more connected. The copyright lawyers would point you rightly towards the authors and publishers, but things get muddy when you have to define the differences between inspired by, mimicry, and actual stealing. And then there are the fan fiction authors. They are passionate readers who try to continue or redo stories by a popular writer. Many of them believe by putting a note on their website saying that they do not make any money for their creations and do it out of affection that they are technically not doing anything wrong. Well, fan fiction authors, tell that to the original creator of that story you love and get back to me. There is a lot of controversy right now around Dave Eggers' great new book, The Circle. Kate Lousy, a former employee of Facebook, claims he plagiarized parts of it from her memoir, The Boy Kings, which is about her time at that social media giant. Dave Eggers denies it. While I have not read The Boy Kings, I hope Facebook is not like the fictional company The Circle. If it is, we are all in trouble. See, the novel The Circle asks a similar question to that modern-day conundrum of who owns a story. Who owns an experience, a life, a moment? And do we have a right to privacy in our social media world? Because in having a secret, we are denying someone else something that they want. Shouldn't knowledge be available for all? Recent college graduate Mae Holland is hired to work for The Circle, which is obviously influenced by Google, Apple, and Facebook. This tech company is focused on finding new ways to connect us through social media and invention to solve all of our problems and unite the world. And over the course of the book, we see The Circle grow in its cultural influences. Each step The Circle takes feels natural and terrifyingly possible. Let me give you an example. First, with small cameras that can be placed anywhere. Keep an eye on the elderly, watch your kids, keep a check on dangerous hotspots around the world. From there, it naturally evolves into something called full transparency, where people begin to wear streaming web cameras all day around their necks. It is easy to compare this book to the work of George Orwell and Kurt Vonnegut, but in a way, it is much more frightening because it is very possible now, right now. 1984 has come and gone. The Circle's world is our world. It is a book I wouldn't hesitate to recommend, especially to those who work for the companies that inspired it. As a literary fan, I cannot help but be awed by Dave Eggers' writing in this novel. From his beautiful use of symbolism and strong characters to his realistic plot and uncanny ability to see both sides of an argument. For every moment that you squirm, he has a counter-argument that seems to justify that discomfort. Yes, they can insert chips into children so kidnappings can be stopped. But those children will also be traceable for their entire lives. Thanks to that chip, you will always know where someone is and what they are doing. Sadly, when you Google this novel today, more comes up in the searches around the possible plagiarism than the actual book. When that battle is done, no matter which side wins, the victims will be the readers who do not give this important novel a chance. This book is part of a conversation we need to have as a culture, no matter who may or may not own this story. For Current State, this is Scott Southard.
Current State contributor Scott Southard is author of the novels A Jane Austen Daydream and Maximilian Standforth and the Case of the Dangerous Dare. More of his writing can be found at his blog, The Musings and Artful Blunders of Scott D. Southard. It's Current State on WKAR. Tomorrow marks the opening day of Michigan's first wolf hunt. In nearly 40 years, the state has issued 1,200 hunting licenses to kill 43 wolves, all in the Upper Peninsula. The hunt is not without its share of controversy, however. The state legislature outmaneuvered opponents' first attempt to halt the hunt with a statewide referendum. Currently, efforts are underway to put the wolf hunt up to a vote in 2014. And recently, State Senator Tom Casperson from Escanaba, a strong proponent of the wolf hunt, apologized for using a fictional account while urging Congress in 2011 to remove the gray wolf from the federal endangered species list. Michigan's American Indian tribes have been some of the strongest opponents of the wolf hunt. The Saginaw Chippewa tribe, based in Mount Pleasant, is holding a candlelight vigil and sacred fire for the wolf tonight. Joining us by phone to tell us more is Charmaine Shawana, a member of the Tribal Council for the Saginaw Chippewas. Welcome, Charmaine.
Thank you.
Why are you opposed to the wolf hunt?
Well, traditionally, the wolf is a part of our creation story and is also one of the clans that we have of our people. And in the beginning, when the Creator made the earth, there was nothing. And the first, when He sent out His thoughts, the thoughts of the Creator became the stars in the sky. And He sent the first man, which was half man and half spirit, to the earth to name all of creation that had been created. And when Nanobojo, which is his name, was going around and naming all of the plants, every animal, every bird, every fish, they all had a name. And when he was walking, he noticed that there was pears. And he asked the Creator, "Where is my partner?" And the Creator said, "I'll send you one." So he sent him the wolf. And the wolf walked with him, and he helped him, and he helped him name all of the animals. And the wolf became his partner. But in the end, the wolf had to separate and find his own people, and human had to find their own people and their own clan. So that's why today the dogs who are descended from the wolves are our partners in life.
Our modern members.
We like them, yes.
Are modern members of are today's members of your tribe, are they all basically aware of the creation story? Do they all know it?
A lot of people know it, and a lot of people know that the wolf is one of our clans and that we're close to the animals of the world, and we don't like to see any animal killed for sport, which is what we believe this is about.
We're talking with Charmaine Shawana, a member of the Tribal Council for the Saginaw Chippewa Tribe, which is opposed to the wolf hunt, which rebegins tomorrow here in Michigan. Have you been working on the campaign for a referendum?
Well, recently we had Miss Jill Fritz come to the Tribal Council and talk to us about it, and she's the director of the Humane Society of the United States. And she talked to us about the wolf vigil, the wolf hunt, how it started, what happened in the UP to get it going, and we educated her a little bit about what was happening with our community and why we were opposed to it. We had some people in the community that thought maybe we should have a vigil. We have a lodge in back of our school, and tonight all of the kids are going to be there, and we'll have a candlelight vigil. We'll do some teachings about the wolf, we'll have prayer, and we'll have a little meal. Talk about the wolf, Mayingun.
Mayingun is
wolf. Mayingun, yes.
Is wolf. What do you make of arguments of proponents of the wolf hunt, that they are predators, that they've killed domesticated animals, cattle?
Well, there's a show on TV, actually, it's called Below Zero. Do you remember the name of that show? It's a show about Alaska. And the native people in Alaska, they have lots of wolves up there. But what they usually do is kill the alpha male. And then the pack will disintegrate and not kill all of the wolves, which is something to think about. The alpha male is the head of the leader of the wolf clan or the wolf pack.
What do you make of the numbers that the state puts out here? I mean, they claim that there are 658 wolves, all of them in the Upper Peninsula. The hunt, if it's unfolds as the state plans, 43 would be taken. What do you make of those numbers?
Well, I don't know too much about that. I mean, I just know that to kill a wolf who's considered part of our society and part of life is a shame. I can't comment on any of that.
How have legislators, state legislators, reacted to your appeals?
Well, I think all of the tribes in Michigan have sent a letter to the state legislators to let them know that we are opposed to it and that it's not a good idea. It's something that it's part of our story of creation, and they're part of who we are. They're in some societies, they're considered sacred. They are leaders. They are, we're close to those animals.
How many people do you expect to attend your vigil tonight?
Oh, maybe 100. We have lots of kids that are going to be there. We'll do some teachings. We'll educate people about it, and Miss Jill Fritz is going to be there, and I'm sure she's going to tell us a little bit about the wolves and what her organization is doing to help this effort.
I want to clarify, I do believe you meant to say Jill Fritz is the State Humane Society Director, not the National. Tell us again about the gathering here tonight. What are the main pieces of that?
Well, we have a lodge, which is a home, is a structure made with a tarp, and we're going to be out there. There'll be some drumming and some singing, some education, some teaching. We're going to have some soup, and we'll share our stories and our tales about the significance of the wolf and why we're doing this effort, and hopefully we can make a plan to keep ourselves educated about it and teach the kids.
And where specifically is your gathering? Where exactly is that?
The address is 7498 East Broadway, Mount Pleasant. And there's a school there. It says Saginaw Chippewa Academy. In back of the school, there'll be some parking on the side. In back of the school, there's a lodge. And we'll meet out there and have a good time.
Very good.
Supporting our Mayungun.
Mayungun.
Yeah.
It all happens in Mount Pleasant. Charmaine Shawana is a member of the Tribal Council for the Saginaw Chippewa Tribe based in Mount Pleasant. They're holding a candlelight vigil and sacred fire to honor the wolf on the eve of Michigan's first wolf hunt in nearly 40 years. Thanks for joining us, Charmaine.
All right. Thank you.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Thanks for joining us. Tomorrow night at the Wharton Center, a one-woman show examines aspects of bullying and teenage relationships. The Shape of a Girl is a play by Canadian playwright Joan McLeod. Current State's Melissa Benmark recently spoke with the young actress who carries the show.
My name is Paige Hernandez. I like to think of myself as a multidisciplinary artist. I do a lot of dancing, acting, producing, playwriting, directing, kind of a jack of all trades, and hopefully a master of a few of those. But I've been very fortunate. A lot of things have just landed in my lap, and it turns out that I'm good at it. I may have a little bit of OCD, so I think that helps. I'm super organized. I like to make sure things are thorough and complete, and that comes naturally with acting and just figuring out the research for any given role or any given show. So, I do some poetry. I kind of do a little bit of everything. I think I'm a ham.
So tell me a little bit about, is this the only place you're performing, or are you going to be doing it some other places?
We actually start out at the Wharton Center here in Michigan, and then we tour for about a week and a half through mid and northern Michigan. So yes, we will be touring to several different places.
Tell me what the show is about.
The Shape of a Girl is an in-depth look at bullying, specifically among teenage girls. It's about the dynamic that happens among a group of girls in school and what happens in the different roles that are in bullying, whether it's the victim or the bystander or the parent, and what you can do. Because no matter what you do, any kind of action will help anyone overcome that situation. So it takes a really in-depth look at that.
A lot of the other performing that you've done has involved music, hip-hop, dance, and with a one-woman show, it's just you. How do you prepare for that?
It's definitely a lot of work. It's much harder, I think, than being in a full show with a full cast and an ensemble, only because the amount of research that you have to do is even more. You really have to look into each of the characters that you're playing, develop those backstories if they aren't already there or aren't already supported in the text, and then, you know, make sure that you're coming at it with a fair hand. That means you know the work that's involved around the different roles and personalities and perspectives in there. Bert Goldstein, who's directing, is an amazing director because he really challenged me to look at those different things, to really dissect what it is that I'm saying, but also the people around me, and not just play them on a surface level, but dig deeper and look at you know, why they may be doing what they're doing. Because the fact is, if you have someone as a bully, sometimes it's seen as such this huge negative connotation, but the truth is that they're hurting too. There's something else going on there that makes them act the way they do. And it's not necessarily to sympathize with them, but it's to understand.
But that's got to get tiring.
It's exhausting and heavy, but it's also very rewarding. And just to get the word out and to make sure that people see it. And if they see it, like I said, with a very wide perspective almost, like a wide shot lens, then I think a lot of people can walk away with a new and refreshing take on what bullying is and what they can do about it.
Sometimes when a person moves on from being a teenager, and I know you are young, but I'm thinking you're maybe not 15.
No, maybe not.
What, I mean, is it hard to revisit some of those feelings?
Sure, but I think what's surprising is that they're all there and they're all vivid. It just takes a small trigger. And that to me is fascinating. And it's one of the reasons why I wanted to work on the show, just because of how much I can relate to Brady. She's the main character, but as well as the other characters. It's all there. You know, you, as an actress, you pull on your experiences, your own real life experiences. And we like to think that, or I like to think that a lot of it is suppressed or maybe erased or thrown away, but it's there. And as an actress, you can and you shouldn't ignore it because it gives you great depth.
Where do you think, when you were the age of the main character, where do you think you were in that ugly pecking order that girls have amongst themselves? Were you the bullied what were you?
You know, I struggled a lot. I grew up in Baltimore in all public schools, all African-American population. It was sheltered in the sense that we weren't necessarily able to see different cultures or different kinds of life until I discovered the arts. I always tell everyone that, you know, the arts didn't save my life. The arts gave me a life. And it wasn't until I started embarking on the arts and finding that outlet that I could really get a grasp, some kind of control over that pecking order. But yes, I've unfortunately been a victim. When you go to a new school, what that means, and I did have to move to a new school. And then I've also been on Brady's side. She's the main character of the show, where she's just able to see what's going on in the hallways, what's going on outside in the parking lot. And what do? Do you stay silent just to protect yourself? Do you interject? Do you intervene? I think a lot of those choices, unfortunately, are common for a lot of teenagers.
You do a lot of work as an educator, it sounds like, from your website. What do you do to inspire kids to be better to each other, for one thing?
Yeah. I try to, as much as possible, to give them a full exposure to the arts. I come from an underserved community, so it's important for me to continue to work with that population and letting them see that they can express themselves. One thing that I wanted to see as a young girl was more people like me on stage. I would go to these shows, everything from classical theater to The Glass Menagerie and Death of a Salesman, and I never saw my story on stage. I never saw anyone who looked like me, who talked like me. So what I'm able to bring to the table is that same experience for someone young. For them to be able to see a role model that looks like them and talks like them, that's submersed in hip-hop, because I love hip-hop. I'm a B-girl, so that's pretty natural for me. And that's what I want to give to them, that opportunity to say, look, here I am. Here I am as an example. I'm positive. You can do the same thing. I'd like to see it, so I hope I inspire you to do it.
That's interesting also in light of the play being a Canadian play. So that's, you know, maybe a little bit not quite the Baltimore experience, and yet you're making it your own.
Yeah, you're absolutely right about that. And that's something that myself and the director, Bert, have been talking about a lot. And that comes in with the research as well, just looking into Canadian culture and understanding that, you know, bullying is universal. So even though it's not from the perspective that I grew up with in Baltimore, it's still a very real thing. And it's just trying to wrap my brain around what I can offer to the role, but also what the playwright puts in the text, and then what Bert is able to inform me about, just in terms of how it works best in this area. But you're absolutely right. Yep.
So after this show tour, what's your next project or projects, it looks like, from your website?
I'm developing a new play called The Nayaka Project, which looks at hip-hop dance fusing with Indian classical text, which is really cool. That premieres March 1st. And then In January, I have a series called Liner Notes, which explores the intersection of hip-hop and jazz music. I also have a children's show, All the Way Live, that was commissioned by the Smithsonian, which goes up again for February and Black History Month. Lots and lots of things. Oh, and then I get to play Cinderella. I get to play Cinderella this spring at Imagination Stage in Maryland.
Well, Paige Hernandez, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you.
For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.
Fascinating sounds. The sounds of Turkish music here being performed live at WKAR's Studio S. This group of musicians from Turkey will be at East Lansing's Kellogg Center tonight. The name of the concert is Heritage of 1,000 Years, and it features Turkish classical music played on traditional instruments. The players this morning, we want to identify Yavuzhan Erdem, who plays the tanbur, which is the stringed instrument you heard being plucked a minute ago. And we also want to acknowledge our ney player. The ney was the flute-sounding wind instrument there. Morats Tokach is the player of the ney. And we also welcome a fellow tanbur player from Ann Arbor, who's also a member of the group and is sitting at the microphone right across from me, Alex Terzian. Welcome to all of you to Current State.
Thank you.
How did the three of you come to know each other here? How did this group come together?
Well, I discovered the tambur by accident on YouTube.
Really?
And I heard of a tambur player in Ann Arbor, and so I arranged a meeting, and we met through the instrument, and Dr. Tokach is Yavuzhan's master teacher, so this is from the lineage of the players of the tambur that goes back from teacher to teacher.
So Morats Tokach plays the ney, and he plays the tambur as well.
Yes.
Is that it? And tell us a little bit more about the instruments. The stringed instrument is the tambur.
Yeah, no, the tambur has, there's a lot of different instruments known as a tambur. So if you call it the Turkish tambur,
okay,
classical, has the microtones. So it's this very long neck. So it allows you to play these in-between notes that gives you this kind of feeling that emulates maybe the vocal styles of being able to bend the notes.
Are those harmonics or not?
Well, they're kind of in between. So the Turkish scales codify these microtones, whereas in the West maybe we have sharps and flats.
Mm-hmm.
Where they have commas that break the notes into finer pieces.
So we actually have more tones to Turkish music?
More notes that are kind of codified, so it gives you that type of sound.
That sound. And the ney, tell us, how old are these instruments? Do these go back centuries?
I'm sure the ney goes back very far. It's an end-blown reed flute. I'm certainly not an expert on them as Dr. Tokach is, but it's a very old instrument.
I'm wondering if we can have each of the players just play a few seconds of your instrument solo, just so we can get a little bit better handle on that. Ahmed Erdem, why don't you just strum a few chords on your tambour? I think I can hear the middle tones that you were alluding to just a second ago, Alex. And Murat Tokach, play a few notes for us on the ney. Very interesting. Are there more tones that come through the flute as well, of the ney?
The way he fingers the holes can allow you to bend the notes and give you that similar kind of thing where you're moving through the scale in a way that is giving you all these micro tones,
exactly.
So to speak.
Very interesting. Micro tones. How long have you two, have these two been playing?
How many years?
More than 10 years?
Over a decade. Okay. And this is, I mean, your performance tonight is referred to as Turkish classical musical. Okay. Are the pieces that we're hearing, would those be regarded as classical music in Turkey?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And
so
the
tambour is associated with classical music. It's more of a kind of a higher order instrument in that sense,
okay.
I guess.
And how many young Turks end up picking up the tambour and the ney? Is it common for young people to pick it up, or is it less common?
Well, I would say the tambour is less common. There's other more folk instruments, such as the balama, that tend to be more played. It's like a simpler version of these lute family of instruments.
Okay.
So the tambour is probably less common. As a matter of fact, Yavuzan once told me, someone saw him with the tambour and said, "Why don't you play the balama?" So you know, it's a more of a unique thing.
Now the pieces that we heard a minute ago, would those be recognized by a good number of Turkish people?
I think so.
Classical music.
Yes.
It's really there's a great awareness amongst the Turkish people of the songs that we just heard a minute ago.
I think so. Yes.
And on what occasions would you hear this? Is this performed? Is this music performed in concert? Do you hear it on the radio? It's obviously on YouTube.
Right. So, yeah, but I think it's an integral part of the culture. So people are very much aware of it. Maybe they may not be able to play it themselves, but they certainly appreciate it and know about it. So,
and what is the significance of 1,000 years? Your performance tonight is called Heritage of 1,000 Years. Did something significant happen 1,000 years ago? Did these instruments really take hold 1,000 years?
It's like this lineage of tradition that's been passed on for many, many generations. So it's maybe hard to say, you know, these instruments evolved probably from many different influences over the centuries.
Sure.
So, but the significance of this very long neck with 56, has 56 notes on it, 56
My
frets.
God.
So,
yeah.
So that is kind of unique. And it's so you can play that this type of music. It has all the notes that you need to play.
Extraordinary.
And so it needs to be long so you can play all these tiny little notes in there.
Exactly.
If it was shorter, you couldn't fit your fingers in there.
Tell us about tonight's performance. When and where is it? Is the public welcome to attend?
Certainly. It's going to be at the Kellogg Center at 7 p.m., and it's going to be in a workshop type of format. So we want to encourage musicians to come, ask questions, being able to contribute. So it's a concert and a workshop.
And a workshop as well. So amateurs can get their hands on a tambour tonight?
I think so, so to speak, you know, could be.
Don't tempt me. I'll be there. We want to thank our players, Ahmed Erdem and Murat Tokac, and they are going to play us out here of this segment. So, The Heritage of 1,000 Years, the music, classical music of Turkey. Classical music of Turkey. Our players are Ahmed Erdem on the tambour and Murat Tokac on the ney. That's Current State for Thursday. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thank you for joining us. This is 90.5 WKAR.